Britain's favourite broadcaster, David Attenborough, once said, "Anyone who thinks you can have infinite growth in a finite planet is either a madman or an economist." But our political leaders don't seem to agree. Both our major political parties have made growing the economy a key metric for their success in government.
Conservatives know lower taxes mean higher growth. Higher growth
means more opportunity, more prosperity, and more funding for our precious public services.
The defining purpose of the next Labour government, the mission that stands above all others, will be raising Britain's productivity growth.
The only corner the economy is turning under this government is from stagnation to recession. They left our economy smaller than it was in 2022 when the Prime Minister took office.
So, what is economic growth? How did it become so central to our understanding of the economy? And should we really be striving for infinite growth on a finite planet? Welcome to the New Economics Podcast. This week we're asking, should we grow suspicious of economic growth? I'm Aisha Thomas-Smith. Stay with us. So I'm really delighted this week to be joined down the line by Kate Raworth, economist and author of Donut Economics. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being with us. And I'm also thrilled to be joined by Michael Jacobs, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Sheffield. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Okay, so let's dive in because we've got lots to get through. So after the UK entered a recession in December, figures showed January's GDP squeak into positive numbers, just about. And economists, you know, follow these figures closely, of course. So let's start with the basics. Kate, can you explain what GDP actually is, what it measures, and what it has to do with economic growth?
Yeah, GDP is gross domestic product. So it's the monetary value of the goods and services produced in an economy in a year. So that measures all the consumption that households spend. It measures investments made in the economy. It measures government spending. And then it adds all the exports that we sell, taking away the imports. So it's a calculation of all of the money spent in the economy buying goods and services in this economy. And GDP is the thing that we're talking about when we talk about growth. When economics and economists talk about growth, they're talking about whether GDP is going up or down and how fast it's going up or down. So GDP growth is the increase in the monetary value of goods and services sold in the economy every year.
Okay, that was very comprehensive. Thank you so much. What does it leave out, if that's what it includes?
So what it leaves out is many, many questions about, first of all, where did that GDP come from? What was being sold? Were we selling education, right? Were we paying for more teachers to teach kids and raise the next generation? Or were we paying to clean up an oil spill? It leaves out the question of whose GDP was that? Who's getting the income? So the distribution of the benefits of incomes coming from producing these goods and services, are they going to families who are actually living at the on the margins of poverty and their incomes are going up? Or actually, is it going to the pockets of the already very, very wealthy? So it really matters who's benefiting from this growth. It's missing the value of the assets and the living world on which we depend. So, for example, GDP will count the value of timber, but not the value of the forest, the living forest that was cut down. It'll count the value of paying a childminder, but it won't count the value to families and to our well-being of millions of parents looking after their own kids every day. And finally, it doesn't tell you what damage it's done to the living world, because GDP, economic activity, is inherently very energy intensive and material intensive. So what is the impact upon the planet of generating more and more stuff? It really matters. All these things are left out of it. In fact, the very creator of GDP, Simon Kuznets, way back in the 1930s, he himself gave us the caveat. You know, he said that it can scarcely be taken to measure the welfare of a nation. He knew what was missing out. But of course, the power of this one number, the irresistibility of one number that we can track, is it going up or down? Is my GDP going up or down faster than your GDP? Which countries are growing the fastest? It became a real horse race in the 1960s. In fact, when the OECD was founded in the early 1960s, Article 1A of the goals of the OECD was to have the highest sustained rate of growth. So it became the overriding metric. When President Kennedy stood for election in 1960, he ran on the promise of 5% growth. Story has it, he turned to his economic advisor after he won the election. He said, can we make good on that promise? Right? Promising GDP growth seemed to be promising progress. It was promising prosperity. And maybe in the past, there was a truth in that when our nations were full of labor-intensive industries, growing output of the economy meant more jobs, meant more income into the pockets of ordinary families, meant they were able to afford things. But that close correlation has really been taken apart, and it's no longer anywhere close to enough to say that a growing GDP means a country and its people and the living world is going to be better off. So it's definitely time for new metrics.
I mean, hopefully we'll get into those new metrics and what they could be later in the conversation. But Michael, let's talk about this irresistibility piece. What is it about GDP that makes it so alluring for, you know, politicians and political economists to say this is the one number we should be looking at? And what are the dangers of that?
I think there are two things that are irresistible, one of which is the idea of GDP growth and the other is the substance. So on the idea, as Kate says, it's been the case now for 60, 70 years that this is the main measurement of the success of an economy. And in the shorthand that is used in political debate and in the media, this is what is understood to be the thing that is that we need. And therefore, it's the easiest thing for politicians to do to go along with that consensus normal view. And most politicians are loath to try and change the normal view. They want to be in the debate that other people seem to be having. So the easiest thing for a politician to do is simply to say, look, I'm in favour of economic growth because that is what one is expected to be in favour of, even though I'm sure many voters don't understand exactly what it is and are possibly not even bothered by that number. Nevertheless, that is the nature of the debate and politicians rarely shift beyond it. The substantive reason why politicians are in favour of economic growth and want more of it is that some of the things it does are useful and good. So it is the case that if more money is flowing around the economy, then the tax take of the government is likely to be larger. At an unchanged tax rate, the more GDP you've got, the more tax the government gets. And that means the more money it can spend on public services without raising the rate of tax. And at the moment we have, and people will be aware, we have a relatively high level by post-war British standards of tax to GDP, the ratio of tax as a proportion of national income. And the reason it's high is because GDP has not been rising very much while we've needed to spend money on public services and on servicing debt and so on. And one of the ways in which taxes could be reduced for people would be if we had more economic growth, because there would be more income to go around and therefore the tax take a percentage could be lower to yield the same amount of money. Or if we had more GDP, we could have the same level of tax and have more money for public services. So that's a good thing that comes from having more income flowing around the economy. Up to a point, more income flowing around the economy also generates jobs. This is less obvious than it used to be, as Kate says, because we have a more capital-intensive, more machine-intensive economy than we used to do. But in general, if you've got unemployment in an economy or underemployment, the more GDP, the more jobs are likely to be created. So these are the substantive reasons why we might want more GDP. The question that Kate raises completely correctly is not every unit of GDP is equivalent. You can raise GDP in lots of different ways, some of which are more damaging and some of which are less damaging. And the problem with a debate which just focuses on this one number and assumes that if it is a higher number, it's better, is that it makes no distinction between different things that could be growing, the different distributional impacts of those things and all the other qualifications that Kate has already given us.
I think one of the things that's so fascinating, as you've touched on, is the fact that it doesn't differentiate between good economic activity and bad, in that, and I remember reading something, I think it was 2017, that there was a massive cocaine seizure off the coast of Scotland and their GDP was higher than it had been in the past 10 years and everyone was very happy about it. But in fact, arguably having a lot of cocaine floating around, perhaps not good economic activity, some would argue. And I think as well, we'd looked actually at the New Economics Foundation, a study that was done by a FT journalist, I think it was David Trilling, who looked at GDP in Japan. And he said, you know, of course, that's a country with quite a low GDP and a high debt to GDP ratio. And so what you would assume is that you'd go there and find, you know, a stagnating economy and everyone being miserable. And it was quite the opposite, you know, such a high standard of living and generally across these other metrics that you were just laying out there, much higher levels than we see perhaps in countries like the UK. So, yeah, I think it's really important to kind of drill down on this idea that there's so much that it misses out, as well as you say, Michael, being really useful. So Rishi Sunak made growing the economy one of his five big promises to the electorate. And Keir Starmer has said that economic growth will be the Labour Party's obsession if they get into government. So both of the big political parties keep banging on about growth. Michael, what should we make of this? Beyond what you've said in that first answer, is there a space for a conversation about alternatives to growth in the current political climate?
In the very short term, no. We're running into an election campaign. The one thing that political parties are loath to do in election campaigns is put forward really radical views that the other side can trash, the media can trash, and so on. And because this is such a consensus in the mainstream, I don't think we do. But it isn't that long ago that politicians were willing to talk about other kinds of objectives. For example, Theresa May was talking early on in her, what turned out to be a rather ill-fated premiership, but early on when she was elected, about the burning injustices in a society that had become more unequal. Boris Johnson wanted to level up. And those are different objectives. Those are basically saying our goal isn't just growth. It is about the distribution of that growth, and indeed of just the income, whether or not it's growing. And the Labour Party has at many points in its history said, we are not just about growth, we are also about distribution and environmental protection. The Climate Change Act, passed by the Labour government in 2008, is a very interesting example of this. The Climate Change Act says that by law, the UK will produce a maximum amount of greenhouse gas emissions in every five-year period on a declining trajectory to net zero. That is a piece of law, and it therefore overrides other economic activities. And by law, the UK government is required to achieve a climate goal of reducing emissions, whether or not GDP is rising or not. And it overrides, it trumps GDP as a goal, which is not enshrined in law. And no party has said we are going to have our GDP goals enshrined in law. So that's an interesting example where effectively we have acknowledged, and it's been accepted broadly speaking across the spectrum, political spectrum, that there are other objectives and we shouldn't be measuring our success as an economy, our success as a country or as a government simply by the rate at which GDP grows. And we need a bit more of that. We need a bit more acknowledgement that there are these other objectives and they may actually be more important than the rate of growth.
Yeah, Kate, what do you think?
I think it's really fascinating to me what's happening in the UK at the moment, that literally the leaders of both political parties have said growth, 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 because I'm not seeing that narrowness and stripping it down literally this one word, one objective happening in other countries. In the 2010s, when I was writing Donut Economics, I was really listening to the way that political leaders were talking about growth, and they would always caveat it, right? So growth is the noun, and there were always adjectives added. We want clean, resilient, smart, lasting, shared, balanced. There were so many words added in front. It was like, clearly you want something more than growth, folks. And then it was Trump, actually, when he stood for election. He stripped all those adjectives away and he went, growth, 3%. Maybe I can get 4%, even 6%, he would say. And I thought, are you intentionally harking back to Kennedy? This is extraordinary. You've just taken away all the nuance and you've removed what we've learned, that we live on a finitely, delicately balanced living planet and that we need to live well on that planet. You've stripped all that away and gone back for the very simple message, you know, kind of goes along with build that wall and I'm just here for growth. So I was just really shocked when this became the picked up message also here in the UK. Let's just go for that almost Trumpist simplicity message of growth, growth, growth. And I'm wondering, is it because Brexit, right, which hasn't delivered the great boon that was promised, and COVID? So we've lived through two dampenings. I think some of it is the promise of, don't worry, people, we can return to it, some kind of dynamic heyday before these crises that have hit us. I'm just wondering whether psychologically that's what the promise is, because it's so darn simplistic to say, you know, we want to have the highest growth rate in the G7. It's like, is that really what people in this country want, to be kind of competing against other countries? It's so 1960s to compete against other nations to have the highest GDP growth rate. So I'm just really struck by how reduced the space of political debates become around what is the goal of the economy here.
I mean, it's interesting. As much as I think we could spend the rest of this podcast talking about the current political moment as it relates to the discourse around growth, because I think there's a lot to say there, especially when it comes to Labour leadership, I have to drag us back from that because I want to talk about alternatives. I want to talk about the degrowth movement, because I think that's obviously a really important thing to bring in here. So taking a step back from looking at the specific moment we're in and thinking about when the economy is shrinking, you know, it does tend to lead to a rise in fears of debt, unemployment, falling living standards, all the stuff we've been talking about. So a lot of environmentalists and other economists advocate a degrowth model. I'm not sure who wants to kick us off with what the heck that is.
Kate?
So degrowth is really important to define it clearly, because sometimes people think, well, if growth is GDP going up, they might think, oh, does degrowth mean GDP going down? And that's not what at all is meant by people at the forefront of this movement. So if you listen to Jason Hickel or Yorgos Kallis, who are two of the leading figures in the movement, they'll say degrowth is about reducing the energy and resource use in an economy in a planned way, reducing it from the less necessary forms of production so that we bring our energy use and our material use back to enable us to live within planetary boundaries. Because we need to start by recognizing that all high income countries, and this one absolutely included, are massively overshooting our global share of resource use through carbon emissions, but also through material use. So it's about coming back within planetary boundaries. And that's at the heart of what Donut Economics is about as well. It's doing that in a planned way. And it's doing that in a way that we invest in ensuring that everybody in a society can live well. So it's in a planned and just way. So it's about coming back and living well within the limits of the living world and ensuring that everybody can meet their essential needs. And that's a very, very different project from, hey, let's pursue growth and hope that it sort of trickles down and we'll raise all boats and we'll, it'll somehow be green. It's putting human well-being and ecological integrity first, and then saying we need to redesign our economy so that they deliver that.
You did touch on it there, Kate, but for listeners who haven't read Donut Economics, could you just give us a brief explanation of, you know, of the concept as it relates to what we're talking about?
Sure. So as we've said here, the goal of economies from over 70 years has been growth. And if you think of the shape of progress of that, it's this line that goes up, 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 rising ever, ever through the ceiling, ever rising line, ever increase. Well, Donut Economics starts with a completely different place and says actually the goal is to meet the needs of all people within the means of the living planet. And when I sat down and had a go at drawing something like this just over 10 years ago, it came out looking like a donut with a hole in the middle. So you want to leave no one in the hole. That's where people are falling short on life's essentials. But you also don't want to overshoot the outer edge. That's where you're putting so much pressure on the planet. We break down the life-supporting systems of the only known living planet in the universe. We'd be crazy to do that, but we're in the process of doing that. So you want to live in the donut-shaped space in between. It's about a space of finding thriving in balance, meet the needs of all within the means of the planet. It's actually a really radical transformation of what we think the shape of progress is, but it's one that's deeply familiar to us in our own bodies. We know in each of our own bodies, we need enough food, but not too much, enough oxygen, enough heat, enough water, enough stress through exercise, but not too much of any of these things. And finding that healthy balance is exactly what enables us to stay alive and stay healthy. So I think the metaphor from the human body to the planetary body is we need to learn to thrive. And to just to finish that off, you know, if my friend goes to the doctor and the doctor tells her she has a growth, we don't celebrate that. We don't think that's good. We know that that is a threat to her body. We call it cancer. It's something in the body trying to grow for its own sake, for its own end. It's threatening the health of the whole. Well, we can take that as a metaphor. If we take the economy, as we call it, and we're trying to grow just financial value, which is what GDP shows up as, we're trying to grow financial wealth and value. It's coming at the expense of the whole. It's coming at the expense of the living world. It's also coming at the expense of a far, far more just distribution of society. It is going to undermine the health of the whole if that becomes the overriding goal. So let's come back to the donut. We meet the needs of all within the means of the living planet. It calls for a really transformative relationship through markets, through government regulation, through the way we live to do that.
I mean, it makes sense to me, of course. I'm going to come to you, Michael, to play devil's advocate. And, you know, as to why degrowth approaches and perhaps a donor economics approach has not yet, you know, taken the world by storm. Why are we not doing it?
Let's come back to the definition of degrowth, because Kate has given the most generous account of degrowth. I think what Kate's just said is that you will end up with a donut economics approach, because it is about trying to make sure everybody lives decently within the ecological limits of the planet. Unfortunately, I don't think that's what the term degrowth implies to most people. And some of the writing about degrowth has not taken that approach. And the problem is, it's a focus on growth. It's just negative. And it's always felt to me, I first started writing about this a very long time ago in the 1980s. The problem is that growth doesn't measure what we want out of life or society or economy. And therefore, degrowth doesn't either. The focus on monetary transactions, which is what GDP is and therefore what growth is wrong, both when we're considering, is this what we want? We want more of it. Well, no, not if it's not being done in the right way. But equally, do we therefore just want less of it? No, in my view, not if that's done in the wrong way. And my problem with degrowth is not the vision that Kate has just set out or the vision of donut economics, which I am a great supporter of. And I think Kate's done an amazing job in reconceptualizing the nature of economic activity and the way we should think about it. But I don't like a focus on growth, neither positive nor negative, because I don't think that measures or describes what we want. And so my problem with degrowth is that it's a misfocus. We shouldn't be thinking about it in terms of the growth debate, but just reversed. Kate has described it as not about reducing GDP, but about reducing the material and energy throughput in the economy. I completely support that. And indeed, almost everybody who has thought about our ecological impact supports that. They have to. We are way overshooting. When I say we, I mean mainly the industrialized countries, but as a species, we are taking way too much from the natural environment and putting way too much back into it in the form of pollution, greenhouse gases, and many other forms of pollution. And therefore, there is no sustainable life on this planet unless we reduce our material and energy throughput. If that's all that degrowth was, and the degrowth movement, then a lot of people would be degrowthers. The reason that they're not is twofold. One is that there are some people of whom I would count myself a kind of skeptical member who think that it may be possible to do that really radical reduction in the material and energy use of the economy and its pollution while GDP could still rise a bit. The reason being that we could actually organize the processes of production and consumption in such a different way with such less material input that you could still have some rising incomes, particularly for poorer people, while radically reducing your material impact. So that's one reason why degrowth might not be necessary. The other one is this focus on the accounting system and the monetary accounting system. And Kate and I think would both say we need to get away from a monetary transactions way of thinking about what's important in the economy and get to measuring the actual environmental impacts, the actual social impacts, and how people are living and how the planet is living. And those are the things that are really important. And they are not directly correlated with any rate of growth, positive, zero, or negative.
When I listen to the scholars in the degrowth movement, the definition is focused on the reduction, not of GDP. It's focused on the reduction of energy and materials use. And it's very understandable that I think that some people get confused, because when we talk about growth, GDP up, degrowth, energy and materials down, they are not the inverse of one another. So I want to just move away from that specific word, because I don't want us to talk past each other. But where I think Michael's taken this is to the place where it really matters. We can have a great discussion, is around, is decoupling possible? So is it possible to have, let's stick with the UK, to an economy in which we could get back to growth of 2% a year, 2.5%, please, right? That would be much more of a happy space. We could go back to having GDP going up by 2.5% a year, and combine that with having carbon emissions, consumption-based carbon emissions, so embedded everything that we're importing in it, consumption-based carbon emissions falling fast enough to bring us to our commitment to a below 1.5 degree world. And not just carbon emissions, but materials, right? So it's not It's not just carbon that matters, it's biomass, it's metals, it's minerals, it's all the stuff we use. So can the value of our goods and services sold keep rising while we use far, far less stuff? And this, to me, is where the debate is at. If you look at data from 2005 to 2019, 14 years, there's data from Our World in Data across a lot of countries, and the UK included. It shows something that we should all celebrate as a success, because we all, whether you're degrowth or green growth, we all need this to happen, which is GDP has been rising while carbon emissions on a consumption basis have been falling. GDP rose about 22% over that period, while carbon consumption-based carbon emissions fell 28%. That looks at first flush like, oh, green growth, growth going up, it's green. It looks like success. And I think there's a real danger that people call success. We're in a new paradigm. This is it. We've done green growth. We are not at all there yet. And here's two reasons why. One, the carbon emissions were falling around 1% to 2% a year. But if we're to come back within planetary boundaries and to cut our carbon at the scale and speed that's required, it needs to be falling five times as fast as that. So, and to Michael's point, the question is, could we be cutting our carbon emissions five times faster than we're doing now and have GDP keep going up? To me, that's a real question. Of course, it's about the future. All the data's from the past and it's the future. And people who believe in the possible technology transformation will say, yes, yes, we can. And others will say, we just can't and we have to face up to it. But I just want to add one more thing. I've just been talking about carbon. It's also about the materials. It's about the water we use, the minerals, the metals. And that hasn't even begun to start decoupling. It's still highly coupled to GDP growth. So then we have to take a position on the future. Do we think technologies and really radically more efficient ways of using resources means we could couple that with continued growth, GDP going up, and we just radically reduce our resource use? Or, and that's the green growth future, or others, and I'm noticing more and more, my goodness, when I speak in universities, when I speak to young people in university, there's the majority of people, and I get them to vote on this, and the majority of people are now putting their hand up and saying, I think it's not possible to separate them. And I think we're actually going to have to look at economies that don't expect to grow. I'm talking about high income countries, economies that don't expect to grow, because to cut our carbon emissions, to cut our material use at the scale that planetary stability demands, just doesn't look like it's compatible with GDP continuing to go up. And I recognize there are people with strong reasons on both sides of that debate. I personally lean into the skepticism of the possibility of having green growth, because I think there's a real danger that we cross our fingers, believe in it and pursue it, and it doesn't come through. You can bet as hell you're going to get the growth without protecting the planet. It is the planetary stability that will be sacrificed if the two can't be separated. And so at an ethic of planetary integrity, I think we need to learn to take our structural dependency on growth out of the equation. And that's a really hard thing to say in the run-up to an election, because no politician wants to look at that.
I'm going to bring you in, Michael, on that, specifically on green growth in a second. But I think what I wanted to just offer is, often when we're really kind of embedded in these debates on a day-to-day basis, right, we can get a little bit caught up in the, well, this group of people think this and this group of people think that, and do I align myself with them or these kind of people? And I think for most of our listeners, they won't be familiar with the kind of, you know, in-depth growth or degrowth or green growth or all these kind of things. All they're getting, and I guess I'm kind of a bit of a conduit for that at the moment, is I think what we can agree on is that this measure that we currently have of GDP is so deeply insufficient. And then there's this much broader conversation about the ways in which we want to be growing and, you know, if we want to be growing at all. And I think all of that is really, really fascinating. But right now, in this kind of moment, political moment, as you said, Kate, it feels like there's perhaps two conversations that are being had. One is, I guess, the more philosophical one of, do we want to be growing at all? And what could that look like? And what does it take into account? And then the other one is, what are the metrics that we're currently measuring ourselves by and who's winning in that race? And I think for me, as a listener who's not an expert in these things, that they're the kind of main two tracks that, you know, are going on in my head. And so it would be great to hear a little bit more about the concept of green growth and what it is, because I think we've been throwing it around, but we've not yet dived into it. So, Michael, maybe if you could just give us a quick overview of the idea of green growth.
It is essentially the idea that if you changed what you produced and how you produced it, how a country produced its GDP, you could potentially increase your GDP while reducing your environmental footprint. But as Kate has pointed out, that isn't good enough. Just reducing your environmental footprint is no longer enough because we are so far off a sustainable level of environmental impact that some reduction isn't enough. We have to get down to a sustainable level of environmental impact, and that's a long way below where we are. And therefore, it isn't enough to have some green growth. You have to have enough green growth to be sustainable. And that's a much bigger challenge than getting a little bit of it. And for a long time, the debate about green growth was really whether it was conceptually and technically possible to have rising GDP while falling environmental impact. And that was often treated as a philosophical question. I always regarded it as an empirical one. I wanted to see the evidence on whether it was possible. And as Kate says, actually, on some environmental indicators, but not all of them, particularly on carbon, we have indeed managed that. And almost all industrialized countries have been growing greenly over the last decade, a decade and a half. But not enough, and that's the problem. And not enough in the two dimensions that Kate mentions. One is we've not reduced our greenhouse gas emissions enough to get us down to a 1.5 trajectory. And we haven't been doing it across all environmental issues. So yes, carbon, but absolutely not on water, soil, fish stocks, and other things. And doing it across all of them is obviously much, much more difficult than doing it on one. Interestingly, because we conceive as climate as this kind of, you know, huge catastrophic crisis, the odd thing about the climate crisis is the technical solutions are relatively simple. We actually know how to produce energy without fossil fuels. We have now become not just technically adept at it, but economically adept at it. It is cheaper in most parts of the world now to produce power, but not heating or cooling or transport, but power renewably than it is through fossil fuels. Technically, the solutions on carbon emissions don't look that difficult. Technically, the solutions on fish stocks, on soil, on water look much, much more difficult. It doesn't look to be as easy as just changing a technology from a fossil system to a renewable system. And so the challenge, I think, across those other environmental indicators is much, much greater. And of course, this has to be done globally. It's not enough for one country to do it. And this is obviously a huge challenge, then, a distribution of who is doing the reductions. And without any question, it has to be the richest countries, because they've already plundered most of the world's resources. And so this is not just about individual national policy, it's also about the distribution of resources. So when Kate says she's skeptical about the possibility of green growth, I think she's absolutely right, and so am I. I'm much more skeptical than I used to be. I still think it's an empirical question, not a philosophical one, but I am much more skeptical about our ability to do it as rapidly, as globally, and across all the different environmental issues than I used to be. And that's because the facts have changed. The question, I think, is what are our strategies for going about this politically? Because this is, in the end, going to be a political choice for societies, for governments, about how they go about this. And just returning to the degrowth idea, I find that not a very good political strategy. I don't think it's easy to get people, either politicians or the public, to rally around an idea that focuses on the growth rate, even if, as Kate says, that's not really the focus of what the leading writers are saying, but it sounds like what they are and what many people assume they are. I don't think that's a very good political strategy. I don't think that's going to win us many supporters. Kate's work, not just in writing Don't Eat Economics, but now working with many groups in different countries who are trying to implement a kind of Don't Eat Economics, seems to be much more successful. I suspect Kate has many more people who are mobilizing around the idea of Don't Eat Economics and trying to put it into practice.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great to hear more about that, because of course, Kate, you're not here to be a representative of the degrowth movement, but I would really love to hear about how the concept of donut economics kind of grapples with these kind of ideas, because something tells me you've thought about it.
Yeah, I'd love to share that. And I'll just start by saying that something that's really struck me over the last, say, 5 years, and I want to note this, the concept of degrowth does have huge traction amongst young scholars and academics. And kudos to them for that. I'm working in a different space, which is with cities and local governments and towns and districts and states. Amongst that community, donut economics has got strong traction. So there are over 80 local governments, city governments, towns, states, districts, counties around the world, a bunch of them in the UK, many of them in Europe, but around the world, who have chosen to use the framing of donut economics in their own work. And so that's really fascinating, as Michael says, you know, what is the framing that will actually have traction that people who need to get elected and re-elected find this a useful way to try and talk to the electorate and their own colleagues about transformations that need to happen. So we're finding that donut economics framework is being picked up in places from Barcelona to Grenoble to Amsterdam to Glasgow to Brussels, Copenhagen, Ipoh in Malaysia, El Monte in Chile, and many other places in between. I think what's happening is that there are people who are elected there knowing that transformation is needed. They want for their community to live well and live well within the limits and respect the boundaries of the planet, to know that the way they're living well there is not at the expense of the whole planet and not expense of people worldwide. And along comes donut economics as a framework that speaks to that and visualizes that in a way that many, many people feel they can get. It's playful, it's inviting. I think that's what's happening. So we're thrilled to be working with councillors and mayors around the world who say, yeah, the donut framework speaks to the vision of what we want to make happen here. And it's not just the donut framework. It comes along with saying, let's transform the dynamics that we're focusing on. So let's not focus on grow, grow, grow. There's two other dynamics we need to focus on instead. We know we've inherited degenerative linear industrial systems. We take, make, use, and throw away Earth's materials. That pushes us over planetary boundaries. We need to become regenerative by design. We need to regenerate the natural landscape. Here in the UK, it's particularly urgent because of the loss of nature. We need to regenerate and reuse the materials we use in building. I was with Architects Declare in Parliament two nights ago. They're calling for the UK government to introduce legislation that stops construction from being such a degrading industry. They use 50% of materials in the UK, 60% of waste generation, 40% of carbon emissions, all coming out of the construction sector. It could become circular. So we reuse, we retrofit, we refurbish, and there is no waste. Everything is a material for use. So that's just a really practical example of how we could make a regenerative industry in this country by changing the regulations. We know we've inherited divisive economies that capture value and opportunity in the hands of a few. The UK is one of the most unequal in Europe and amongst high-income countries. So this is a big one for us. We need to be far more distributive of opportunity and of value that's created through who owns the land and housing, who owns those small enterprises, who owns the utilities. We can redistribute through a far more democratic ownership of the sources of wealth creation. So donut economics says, yes, set the goal of living well within the means of the planet here. Let's be distributive and let's be regenerative in the way we transform our economy. And we're just finding that local governments are saying, this speaks to the values we have. In fact, when we go doorstep to doorstep, people want to live in thriving communities where there's good jobs being created locally, where the environment, the air is clean, the river is clean, the kids can bike to school. What's not to like? That is a strong alignment with living within the donut. So I think there are real ways of escaping from growth, up, down, financial value. That's not the truth of people's day-to-day lived lives. We can create communities that are far more healthy and stronger well-being within an ecologically thriving place. So this is the political narrative that I'm really trying to help build through the language of donut economics, learning all the time from local policymakers. How do they talk about it? How do they express it? What can we learn back and echo back from them?
Yeah, and as you say, what resonates in different contexts and how we can feed that back into the donut. Amidst all these different ways of talking about economic growth, I think we've actually landed where I wanted to land, which is talking about building public consensus beyond, within, around this idea of growth. So, Michael, where do you think most people in the UK are when it comes to growth? Do you think it's a general concern?
I don't think most people understand it. I think they hear it in the media, but they're not absolutely sure what it is. And they don't immediately assume or associate growth with an improvement in their well-being, their standard of living, the quality of life in their place. And that's because it doesn't correlate with those things for most people. We have now got a system of growth, insofar as we've got any growth at all, which puts most of that growth into the hands of the people who are already well off, leaves many communities, not just the individuals within them, but the actual communities, the fabric of social life, struggling or getting worse, and creates environmental problems. If that's the kind of growth that exists, that actually people see, then no, I don't think growth is what they want. We're pretty simple creatures. We want a better quality of life for ourselves. We want to live in communities where people feel secure, where they feel some connection with the strangers whom they live amongst. That gives a feeling of security and community and belonging. And now we all know we need to live on an ecologically sustainable planet. Those three goals that I would describe, which in simple terms, well-being, we want to live well, a reduction in inequalities, that's the way I put it, that the inequalities have grown too large and we should be reducing them, and we need to live sustainably. I think I would probably add a fourth, which is that we need to have resilient economies that are not quite so battered by the shocks that come at us. So those four seem to me to be a much better way of conceptualizing the goals of an economic system and a better economic policy than growth, which is only contingently related to any of them and increasingly not related well to any of them. It's a much more resonant thing to be talking about for ordinary people, because in general, that's what most people want to. And if you do that, if you say growth is not the primary goal, it's these four, as I would put it, much more important paramount goals, then you start looking at what will give you those things. And the great, you know, work that Kate does with the local authorities and communities that are interested in donut economics is that's what they're looking at. They're looking at what are the ways in which we can provide a decent level of income for everybody? What are the ways in which we can improve the quality of life that we share in the communities that we live in? How do we make sure that we are not simply extracting from the natural world, but we are creating, as she says, a circular economy? And frankly, whether or not we generate any GDP growth at the end of doing that, I am much, much less interested in, because I think that what we really want are those four goals. And that seems to me to be the way in which politicians ought to talk, because my sense is that that resonates with much more of the public than any talk about economic growth.
Kate, where would you say that folks are at, and how could we encourage, you know, organizations like NEF and listeners to the podcast, encourage support for, you know, policy ideas and a public discourse that moves beyond the kind of static convo about growth?
So I strongly agree with many of the policies that Michael was just laying out. And indeed, the degrowth movement are putting out lots of policy ideas of these kinds of far more equitable futures. They're one of the many contributors to that. So I would love to just sit with this, but I'm going to bring in what I find one of the spanners in the work that, and I, you know, I have to recognize it, which is, as Michael says, you know, if we go for these goals, I don't mind, I don't care whether GDP is going up or down. And yet I'm sure he would also agree with me, but the trouble is at the moment, our economies are structurally dependent upon growth going up. In fact, Michael spelled out some of that at the beginning. So here's just some of the ways, right? Michael pointed them out. Growth isn't going up and businesses are often, you know, trying to use fewer workers to create the same output. You'll get unemployment if you haven't got new companies employing those workers. No government wants an unemployment line growing. If GDP is not rising, then you're not getting that increase in tax revenue unless you raise the tax rate. Governments don't want to raise the tax rate. If you don't have growth, then you might have to face up to the redistributional question without promising that we're just going to grow the pie and everybody will get a little bit of it. Even if that never materializes, growth is a wonderful way of avoiding the redistributional question. And then I want to look at the international one, because for me, this is one of the lock-ins that really matters, is that no government wants to lose their place in the G20 family photo, right? But you get there through power. You get there through being significantly large. And if one country amongst the G20 says, oh, I think we're just going to, you know, we're going to go for a well-being economy and stop growing, they really risk being booted out by the new emerging powerhouses, and that they're giving up some of their geopolitical power, and they may give up some of their power in relation to financial markets as well. So I think there are many ways we're locked in. Also, how we pay our pensions. We all expect that I can put a little bit of money away every month and it will, of course, grow. It'll grow. And so when I retire, there'll be plenty there for me. Well, that was relying on a growth-based economy. So I'm pointing out all the difficult things that come along with the argument that I want to make. And the reason I'm pointing them out is because I think it's incredibly important that from economic students to economists working in treasuries, we need to be looking in the face of how is our economy currently structurally dependent on that expectation of growth. And if it's not coming, whether it's not possible to generate, as Michael said earlier, maybe we're not going to get more than 1%. It's going to be low or slow. Or maybe it's not possible because we cannot decouple at the scale that we require to live within planetary boundaries, which we are obliged to do, then we need to take the growth dependency out of our economies. And it's really uncomfortable, and it's definitely not electoral politics. You know, it's not like election year chat. To me, it's like the existential economic question. How can our economies realize that it's time to have grown up and now just thrive? And GDP becomes a variable that varies, maybe sometimes up and down a bit. That's what I sometimes talk about being agnostic about growth. Could we create economies? You know, the moment we have economies that need to grow, whether or not it makes us thrive. And what we need are economies that make us thrive, whether or not they grow.
I completely agree. And I have been saying this for quite a long time. And the interesting thing is that I started saying this before I went into government. And then when I went into government, I was an advisor in the Labour government. I thought, well, how do we actually do any of this? Because we are in a system dominated rhetorically and actually by growthist policies. And my focus was on the climate has come to the top of the agenda. So let's focus on climate. How would you do this? And the way we devised it was to create a law, as I was saying earlier, which says we are going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions until they are, at that point we said minus 80%, but now we've said until they are zero, net zero. And that is going to override our other objectives. Now, there's obviously a question about whether it in the end will override them. And maybe we've not yet hit where the proverbial X hits the fan. And in the end, that Climate Change Act will be overridden by the imperative of growth. But it hasn't so far been at various points. The government in the last 15 years has tried to do that, actually, but has not succeeded. We put in place a system through the Climate Change Act, which has limited our environmental impact on this one set of indicators, the greenhouse gas emissions, not all the others, in a way that, at least in principle, in the law, trumps growth. And when the two are in conflict, it's going to be the Climate Change Act, which is intended, at least, to be the priority. I'm very interested in the practicalities of this. What, in fact, can we do? 2-3 years ago, the Conservative government passed an Environment Act in 2021, which was structured not entirely dissimilar from the Climate Change Act. It basically says, whether the Climate Change Act says government must introduce greenhouse gas budgets, the Environment Act says it may do. The government may introduce environmental targets, but for across the range of other environmental indicators. And if it sets those targets, then it should have plans to meet them. That act is not strong enough. I think it should be compulsory in the way that it is under the Climate Change Act for government to set declining targets of environmental impact across the whole of the British economy and indeed our contribution to global problems, and to have plans that mandatorily must be plausible ways of implementing those targets, which is basically the structure of the Climate Change Act. I'd like to see the Environment Act beefed up by the next government, probably Labour government, so that it is basically a parallel act to the Climate Change Act. And then we would be forced to say, OK, how do we get our environmental impact across a range of environmental indicators down towards sustainable levels. And that would, if the act worked properly, start to trump the growth imperative. I would actually like to do this on a range of social indicators as well. I would like to see some social rights which effectively do the same thing and say, government, you have to provide a decent home for everybody. That is a law. And your policies have to achieve a decent home for everybody. And that overrides your other objectives. And it feels to me that this would be the practical way of going about trying to get an economy that prioritizes social well-being, reduction in inequalities, environmental sustainability and resilience, rather than growth. And so rather than thinking of this as an entirely kind of theoretical thing that we have to do, or a thing we have to do simply in our minds, which is important, there are, I think, practical ways to do it. And I think there are policies or policy approaches which can help us prioritise the things that are important, even where they may conflict with growth.
Just to add here, so policies like the Climate Change Act in the UK, and these kinds of policies are also becoming real already in Europe. So, for example, in the Netherlands, they use an awful lot of fertilizer in their farming. And the European Commission said, you are over your nitrogen ceiling. It's really fascinating to me that the word nitrogen ceiling is part of the political debate now in the Netherlands. You're using too much nitrogen. You need to reduce fertilizer. Now, again, with many of these issues, because we've left it so late, the scale of reduction required is pretty dramatic, and it kicks off massive political debate and reaction. And it led to the election of the Farmers' Party, which was formed very quickly, a reaction against this. So there's a real danger that because, as Michael said, you know, you've been working on this for 40 years and a long time ago, it looked quite feasible, but we've left it so late, the decline is so steep. I do worry that the political reactions against, we have to do what? How much? So fast? No way. And a pushback against it. But interestingly, in the Netherlands, they've got the European Commission requiring it of them because it's another body saying you must follow these regulations. This is part of what we've committed to as a European community. The UK steps outside of that. So we would have to have the means of regulating ourselves and introducing a nitrogen ceiling on ourselves, as well as a carbon ceiling and a water ceiling and a materials use ceilings. And so I like the spirit of these policies, but are we going to have the gall to do that to ourselves? And then also we have a current government that says, oh, we're going to max out on oil and gas until 2050, like a really cynical way of trying to get around these constraints. But even if we do go with these policies, and I like them, you know, let's put the policies in place and make them first and make them law. Only if we remove the growth dependency in the economy will that growth imperative not rear its head and say, well, it was a nice idea, folks, but in the end of the day, come on, we all know how dependent we are on growth. We can't sacrifice the prosperity of the nation for the environment. We've heard politicians say things like that. So changing the narrative on growth is an important part of making it possible to stick to laws that allow us to pursue something else.
I mean, perhaps it's an overly optimistic place to end, but I think it certainly seems like one thing we all agree on is that people want more than growth in the way it's currently being offered. As we've said, you know, they want to think about the impact on the environment. They want a good standard of living. They want reduced inequality. And ultimately, people are the voters. People are the people who decide. And so, you know, we may not have the infrastructures or the discourse in place at the moment to go where we think we need to go, but it certainly seems like the tide is going in that direction to me.
People want to thrive and they want to know that their kids will have a chance to thrive. And I think when we frame it like that, you get so many more people who can come along with it.
We live in hope. We really do have to end, but the listeners are going to want to know where they can find out more about both of you. So Kate Raworth, thank you so much. How can we get more Kate Raworth?
Well, I hope you get more Donut Economics, actually. So if you go to donuteconomics.org, that is our platform, Donut Economics Action Lab. The name is very intentional. We exist to work with communities and teachers and cities and progressive businesses and architects and doctors to put the ideas of donut economics into action where people are. And we learn so much from the incredible community of pioneers and change makers who are doing this work. So donuteconomics.org, anyone can be a member, use our tools. It's all in the commons. This is how we spread and scale ideas at the speed that's needed these days.
Fantastic. Join Donut Economics. Get your sugar high. Michael Jacobs, same question.
I will leave you some of my writings. Kate is both a writer and an activist and is a very inspirational person, as everybody has heard. So I would really refer you to her site. But if you want to know the things I've been writing about, I'm very happy to leave some references for you at NEF. And then if listeners want to have a look at some of those, they're very welcome to.
Fab. We'll shove them in the show notes. Thanks so much, both of you, for this wonderfully enriching conversation. That is it for today's New Economics podcast, but we'll be back soon with more. If you've enjoyed this episode, please tell someone about it. To find out more about becoming a NEF supporter, you can visit neweconomics.org. The New Economics podcast is brought to you by the New Economics Foundation, produced by Katrina Gaffney, James Rush, and Margaret Welsh. I'm still Aisha Thomas-Smith. See you next time.